Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the nightmare scenario that no one wants and everyone risks. You check into the hospital to be cured, stitched up, saved. A doctor or nurse or dirty doorknob passes you an antibiotic-resistant superbug, and you check out with more trouble than you came with, or worse, check out dead. Nearly 2 million patients now pick up infections in U.S. hospitals every year. 90,000, maybe more, die from those infections. Infection rates are rising. The superbugs get tougher and tougher to treat, and now they're jumping into the community at large, to locker rooms and jails and beyond. Up next on Point, superbugs out of control and how to stop the spreading wave of deadly infection. We begin with a closer look at the latest news on so-called superbugs. Jane Allen is a freelance health reporter who writes for Los Angeles Magazine, Oprah's O Magazine, and has reported for NPR's Weekend America. In 2003 at the Los Angeles Times, she broke the story of a virulent staph outbreak among gay men in Los Angeles County jail inmates. She joins me now from Los Angeles. Jane, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be here.
Tell us what's going on here. Most of us don't spend a lot of time in the hospital. We don't expect to get infected when we arrive there. We'll look at what's coming out into the community. But first, in the hospital, what's going on?
Well, first of all, you need to realize something, that antibiotics and antifungal drugs and antivirals were sort of the great success of 20th century medicine. They were brought to us around World War II, and they really have kept many, many people alive, you know, who had infections that otherwise might have been deadly or very, very dangerous. So they were a great success, and then something changed for us at really the end of the 20th century, where the bugs started to outsmart the drugs. And when that happened, certain types of infections that might even have been somewhat innocuous, like staph infections, boils in your skin, suddenly took on much more importance. And that's really what a lot of the superbug controversy is about. We're talking about mostly bacteria, sometimes fungi, that now are smarter than the drugs, and the drugs no longer work. And that means you can go into the hospital somewhat healthy and pick up a bug you didn't have when you got there, or be treated with an antibiotic and have it not succeed.
Now, we're reading that infections are, the word raging keeps coming up here. I'm looking at the New York Law Journal, USA Today. I don't know if that's journalism speak or if that's an accurate description. Infections affecting one of every 20 patients in American hospitals now. Is that a raging epidemic? And are most of these the infections that cannot be treated by traditional antibiotics?
What's happening is that these infections, with knowledgeable treatment, need to be attacked with different drugs. The problem that I wrote about at the LA Times is called MRSA, methicillin-resistant staph aureus.
Okay.
And that's basically a skin bug that no longer responds to methicillin, which is a penicillin-related drug, and it also defies treatment with many others. Often, these superbugs require that you use what is called vancomycin, an antibiotic called the drug of last resort. Mm. The bigger problem, Tom, is that some of these bugs are now becoming resistant to the vancomycin as well. We talk about methicillin-resistant staph. There's now vancomycin-resistant staph. There's also an intestinal bug called vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, and this is becoming a big worry. Normally, doctors will go to sort of more expensive, harder-to-use drugs that require IV use or hospitalization, but even those are becoming somewhat thin.
And is this just in a few hospitals? Is this in most hospitals? How widespread?
This is everywhere. I think with MRSA, you know, some of the MRSA that I was talking about was actually in the community. It wasn't just that you were in a hospital or a nursing home and got this nasty bug that gave you pneumonia or a blood infection. This was something that was sort of separate but the same basic idea in the community. And people were getting it, you know, people like Sammy Sosa had it. He missed something like 15 or 16 games because he had skin boils. So did Brandon Noble, who was a Washington Redskins defensive tackle. But when you're in the hospital, it can be anywhere. And the statistics now are that more than 70% of the bugs or the bacteria that give you that are responsible for hospital-based infections are resistant to at least one of the common antibiotics. So you need very knowledgeable people to treat them, and it means that the arsenal is getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
What are the typical symptoms of this kind of infection, or are there typical symptoms, Jane? How would a person know if they've acquired this kind of serious infection that's not going to respond well to traditional antibiotics?
Well, part of it is just good diagnosis by your doctors, but there's one particular one that's really interesting, and that's a bug called C. Clostridium difficile, or C. diff for short. Mm. And Clostridium difficile is really kind of a conundrum for doctors right now because the incidence of it actually increases with antibiotic use. That means that people who take antibiotics for fairly routine or somewhat serious illnesses are now developing this nasty little rod-shaped bug in their gut that is multiplying. And the most vexing thing, I think, for physicians is that they've actually seen it in a group of pregnant women. Now, that's the least expected group to come out of a hospital with an infection. So C. diff, it's nasty because you have severe diarrhea, a lot of pain, and that is one of the most vexing new infections or infections that's back on the rise. Very hard to treat, and you're talking about months and months and months of ongoing treatment to try to eliminate it.
Jane, who's vulnerable here? Do you have to be in the hospital with an open wound or some kind of opening in the skin? Or do you have to be in a locker room, a jail, where there may be abrasion or bad hygiene? What's the vulnerability profile?
Well, the interesting thing with MRSA in the community is that you don't have to be having open skin wounds. What happened here in Los Angeles was that it was a particular strain of MRSA seen in a small group of newborns, and then and some young athletes, and then it was being seen in gay men. At one point, people thought it might be an STD, but then the story I wrote at the Times forced LA County health people to come forward and say, well, there is a fourth group of institutionalized patients. We weren't going to reveal it, but it's 1,000 jail inmates in the LA County jails, and there, the culprit is sanitation. It can be just a regular skin infection. It can be passed by towels or not proper hand washing. So for some of these bugs, good hygiene actually works. However, with the C. diff that we were talking about, C. diff spores can live for months on the surfaces of tables and chairs and furniture in a hospital, and that is a really tough problem to combat. Tom, I would note something really unusual that I saw in my research, which is that in Scotland, there's a company that's making special linoleum floors that kills MRSA, and folks in the UK have developed washing machines that use ozone and cold water to try to kill off the C. diff and the MRSA so that it doesn't continue to spread within the hospital.
Wow, bring on the ozone. Jane, you're terrific. You lay out the problem vividly for us, and we're grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Jane Allen, joining me from Los Angeles. With us right now from Charlottesville, Virginia, Dr. Barry Farr, epidemiologist, one of the country's top experts on hospital-acquired infections. He's professor emeritus of infectious diseases at the University of Virginia. Dr. Farr, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You describe a problem out of control in the U.S. healthcare system. What's the scale? Is this 90,000 dead a year from these hospital infections accurate to you? Does that sound right?
I believe that it is correct, and that is an estimate because we don't actually have reporting of each of these like we do with certain illnesses in the country.
It sounds absolutely intolerable, though. 90,000 people dying not from a disease they went to the hospital for or surgery gone bad, but an infection. I mean, are we just putting up with this? Are we just living with this? What's the medical community debate about it?
Well, you have to remember that things have a beginning, and we're several decades beyond the beginning for methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, which you've just been discussing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back in time 26 years to 1980 in the Centers for Disease Control's volunteer program of hospitals that provide a snapshot of what's going on in the country. It's called the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System,
okay,
or NIS. MRSA accounted for 2% of all of the Staph aureus infections in those hospitals in 1980. And in 2003, it accounted for over 64%. So that gives you a snapshot right there that there's been a 32-fold increase in MRSA in American hospitals over that interval.
You call it a problem egregiously out of control. These are the infections not susceptible to traditional antibiotics. So what are the odds a person faces when they go into the hospital of getting an infection like this or even being killed by it?
Well, most people don't get an infection and die, obviously, but a much larger proportion than get infected become colonized, because what you have to understand is this is an epidemic of carriage, of colonization, where there's just invisible spread going on constantly from one patient to another, usually via a contaminated healthcare worker's hands or clothing or medical equipment, going from patient to patient and just dropping the organisms off on from one patient to the next. And as I said, most patients don't become infected with it, but if we're going to control it, we have to deal with the fact that there's an epidemic of colonization. The countries that have dealt with that responsibly have controlled it. The hospitals in this country, where it's, as you said, seriously out of control or egregiously out of control, have controlled it. And some examples are my hospital, the University of Virginia, and did it back in 1980. MRSA arrived at the University of Virginia for the very first time in March of 1978, and it spread out of control for 3 years, getting worse, worse, and still worse until by the third year, it was almost half of all of the Staph aureus infections at the University of Virginia Hospital were the single strain of MRSA that was just spreading patient to patient to patient.
Andrew is calling from Cranston, Rhode Island. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. My father was died last year, and he was hospitalized for about a month and a half. A major reason for him passing was a series of hospital-borne infections, one of which being Klebsiella. One thing that occurred to me during that stay, other than it was very frustrating and upsetting and your sense of helplessness, was that that if some kind of a law was passed or some kind of mandate that said if a hospital or a patient picked up this infection
right.
via a hospital-borne infection, that the hospital would have to actually pay for his care, things would get a lot cleaner.
Andrew, I'm sorry for your family's loss and for your father's passing. Let me ask you, did he die from the infection or die from complications, or they couldn't do surgery because of the infection?
Yeah, they could not go in and do surgery. He had a heart attack while he was actually being hospitalized, and they had to put some stents in, but they couldn't get in for the surgery because he had all of these infections. So we were basically just sitting there waiting for the infections to pass while they did all these different, all these lines going in and out of them.
And what did the hospital say about it? Did they say, we're sorry, we messed up, or that's just the way it is these days?
It seems sort of, that's the way it is. And they're sort of laissez-faire about the infections, and I said, I was constantly like, well, should I worry about coming in or should I worry about walking around? And they're like, as long as you don't have a suppressed immune system, you shouldn't have to worry too much about it. And I feel like it's their way to sort of make sure that the public isn't panicking about it.
Yeah, nobody wants that, but we want to be very clear-eyed about this. Andrew, thank you for your call. Let me get another from Lubbock, Texas. Zoe's on the line. Hi, Zoe, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
This is completely in line with my recent experience. My first bunch of letters I sent to a local hospital about my mother's infections that she got having knee replacement surgery. And my sister and I charted the staff, and more than half the people that walked in her room either used hand sanitizer or washed their hands. And it got to where we were afraid to leave her alone because we weren't there to demand that they be clean.
And how serious were the problems that you think?
She had knee replacement. She ended up getting pneumonia. She is now home with the sores that her personal physician said, it's just epidemic in town.
And you couldn't get the hospital to keep hands clean.
Second bunch to the director of nursing and to the administration. I've heard nothing.
Zoe, thanks very much. Good luck with getting some answers there. Dr. Farr, here's two stories. Are these typical?
I'm afraid that they probably are typical because the infections go on day in, day out, and we can't prevent all infections, and we have to, as Niebuhr said, try to accept with serenity the things that we can't change,
mm-hmm.
but we should do something about the things that we can control. And as I started to say a few moments ago,
yes.
MRSA is out of control in American hospitals, and it doesn't have to be that way. It can be virtually completely controlled, as shown by multiple Northern European countries that have done it throughout their nations, and in the state of Western Australia.
How have they done it? Where it's been done? How has it been brought under control? What's it take?
They've done basically the same thing that was done at the University of Virginia in 1980. They look for it by screening patients that are at high risk to carry it, and then they care for them with what we call isolation precautions. The Centers for Disease Control recommended that every patient with an important antibiotic-resistant organism like MRSA be cared for in isolation back in 1983. But what they did not say was that in order to find the patient, you have to screen for it. You have to do a culture to find it. And so American facilities never started doing that.
You mean when a patient comes into the hospital? In other words, when a new patient comes in, these countries where it's under control are testing them immediately at reception?
They don't test every single patient, but they test the ones that meet criteria for being at increased risk. If you're in Denmark or the Netherlands and a patient comes in from an American hospital where things are out of control, they obviously have to culture that patient, and they even put them presumptively into isolation because they know our hospitals are so seriously out of control.
So they would then know who's got it and can isolate them there. That's something to consider. The United States being seen as a danger zone if our patients end up in Northern European hospitals. That's not the situation we want to be in.
And unfortunately, most countries in the world look to us for scientific leadership, and most countries are failing to control this and following the United States' bad example.
Sean's calling from Walcott, Connecticut. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're very well. What do you know, Sean?
Well, I work as a paramedic part-time, and one of the first things I actually came across in my time was the flesh-eating bacteria. I worked for a hospital that came across the flesh-eating bacteria, saw the first patient in Connecticut, and how devastating that was. But also, we're seeing a high incidence of MRSA in nursing home patients.
This is the MRSA. This is the tough one. How is spreading there as it has in hospitals, you think?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, they're not. You know, we're going into these places, and they stink of urine, they stink of feces, and unfortunately, our people are not getting the care that they need, and they taken care of and being cleaned up the way they should be.
How do you respond personally to that as a paramedic? How do you keep from getting infected yourself?
Well, we try to disinfect our equipment. I actually had a question for Dr. Farr whether Lysol regarding our BP cuffs would be good, because unfortunately we're using one BP cuff in a whole day's time and seeing upwards of a dozen patients. And of course, if they have it, we're going to spread it and are trying to keep it from ourselves by washing our hands, using gloves, and using basic substance isolation processes.
Sean, let us look at that right there, and good luck to you. Stay healthy. Dr. Farr, blood pressure cuffs and Lysol. Sean's out there every day. He's worried about, spreading it, getting it. Is Lysol enough?
Well, there is an antibacterial Lysol product that has the same sort of quaternary ammonium compound that is used in hospitals as the environmental disinfectant and for disinfecting things like blood pressure cuffs. It's very clear that if we do nothing and we just ignore this, which is the American approach and the one that was used at my hospital, as I said, back in the 1970s, we keep contaminating all of the equipment we use, and then we use it on the next patient, and we spread things that way.
How easily does it spread? For example, if a doctor puts a stethoscope on my chest or back, am I at risk?
That is one of the ways. I mean, but there's all kinds of equipment that we use. There's the stethoscope, there's the tourniquet, there's the blood pressure cuff, there's the reflex hammer. There's all kinds of little things that we carry in our pockets, and they can anyone can become contaminated, and then they either recontaminate the healthcare worker's hands if the hands were, you know, happened to be washed, which they frequently aren't, and the white coat, which looks clean, can be contaminated. And, you know, you touch all these things and you move from patient to patient, sort of like the character Pigpen in the comic strip Peanuts.
May not look that way. It doesn't have to be this way, you say, but it is this way right now. Dr. Farr, please stand by in Charlottesville. I want to turn to Southampton, New York, and Betsy McCoy. She's founder and chairman of the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths, a health policy expert at the Hudson Institute. From 95 to 99, she was lieutenant governor of New York during Republican Governor George Pataki's first term. Betsy McCoy, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Why are we not getting on top of this problem? Why is it a growing rather than a shrinking problem if we know how to address it?
Well, 2 points on that. The first is that the CDC are largely to blame, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. For 25 years, they've been tracking the rapid rise in drug-resistant infections, but they have done too little to stop it. And their lax standards are largely to blame for the fact that hospitals have not done enough in the United States to protect patients from these deadly drug-resistant infections. In addition, although we have the science to solve this problem, the will has been lacking. Too few hospitals have made infection control or infection prevention a top priority. In addition, however, there are very, very successful steps that patients can take to protect themselves from hospital infection. And there are 15 steps that are very, very important for all patients to know before they go into the hospital. They're up on our website, www.hospitalinfection.org.
15's a lot, but at this point, I'm sure we have people's attention, and no one wants to get one of these infections. What are the top things that individuals can do? And then we'll talk about the system.
Task anyone who's going to be treating you to clean their hands in front of you ahead of time.
Can you not assume that a medical professional would have done that?
No. In fact, the research shows that doctors fail to clean their hands before treating a patient 52% of the time, and at some hospitals it's much worse than that. Don't be misled or falsely assured by seeing gloves, because if the caregivers have pulled their gloves on without cleaning their hands first, the gloves are already contaminated.
Secondly, are medical staff going to be insulted, affronted, if I say, excuse me, doctor, would you please let me see you, wash your hands in front of my eyes before you touch me?
They shouldn't be, and if you're worried about being too aggressive, just remember that your life is at stake. Secondly, if you're having surgery, a week before surgery, start showering or bathing frequently with chlorhexidine soap. Various brands are available at the drugstore. This will help remove the dangerous bacteria you may have on your own skin that could get into your incision after surgery and cause an infection.
But how common, how big a risk is it? Do most people really go around with these superbugs on their skin in daily life?
Yes, they do. That's the point that Barry Farr was making earlier, that many people are colonized with these dangerous bacteria. Well, they don't make you sick until they get inside your body. And in a hospital, there are 4 ways that happens: through a urinary tract catheter, through an IV in your arm or in a central line into your femoral area, for example. The third way is if you have a ventilator because you're having trouble breathing,
right,
it gets in that way. And the fourth way is an incision if you have surgery.
Barry Farr, what about that? What people carry in normal everyday life that comes with them into the hospital?
Well, most people don't carry, for example, MRSA. I mean, there was a study that was just published several months ago by the CDC which showed that about a third of the population carries Staph aureus, which has afflicted the human population for millennia.
Since Job, you
yeah, I mean,
it caused
boils, and it probably caused Job's boils. But and antibiotic resistance doesn't become a problem until you get into the environment where you're using antibiotics. And once you are doing that and you have an antibiotic-resistant bug show up, then you can't treat it successfully, and that's why it's a problem. And because we use lots of antibiotics in the healthcare facilities,
right,
and because we move from patient to patient frequently with contaminated hands, clothes, and equipment, we move microbes continually. We've known that since the 1840s, from patient to patient.
And yet here we are.
Those two things, provide a selective advantage for the antibiotic-resistant bugs to get more and more and more frequent.
We can see that. Betsy, you say ask visitors to clean their hands, ask them not to sit on your bed because they may pull something in. But then this, you say if you need surgery, choose a surgeon with a low infection rate. How does one figure out if a surgeon, or for that matter, an entire hospital, has a good rate or a bad rate of infection like this?
Well, surgeons know their infection rates for various procedures, and you should have a serious discussion with your surgeon ahead of time and ask him or her, what is your infection rate for this procedure? If a surgeon isn't willing to discuss it, you should wonder why and perhaps choose a different surgeon. Now, on the issue of what are hospitals' infection rates, RID, the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths, is making enormous progress. 9 states have now passed laws requiring hospitals to report their infection rates.
Report it? Post it? How would I know as a patient? Would it be at the front door?
Well, because under all of these bills, eventually the state health departments will post that information on a website. They're risk-adjusted, to be fair to hospitals that treat a large number of patients with cancer or organ transplants other conditions that would make them particularly vulnerable to infection.
Are hospitals fighting that or accepting that?
In many states, the hospital associations, the hospital lobbies have fought tooth and nail against disclosure.
Why?
But in fact, if you have to be hospitalized, you should be able to find out which hospital in your area has the most serious infection problem so you can stay away.
And if hospitals start to post that, are we going to be shocked? Are you concerned that people are going to be afraid to go into hospitals?
Well, people are already very afraid to go into hospitals. Many, many people are already afraid of infection. But knowledge will enable patients and families and insurers and employers who provide health coverage for their workers to make smarter decisions about where they should be treated.
Rebecca's calling from Dubuque, Iowa. Hi, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hi. I was a nursing student in the last couple of years, and I just had a couple observations from a clinical rotation that I did on a skilled rehab nursing unit.
Yep.
When I started my rotation in January, we had 3 patients infected with C. diff. 5 months later, at the end of my rotation, we had 23 patients. And whenever we had a patient with diagnosed with C. diff, the nursing staff was following contact isolation precautions. They would wear gloves and gowns when they went into the room. However, stethoscopes, blood draw trays, thermometers, things like that were carried into the room, used on the patient, set on bedside table, set on the bed, picked up, and they'd walk out of the room, take their gowns and gloves off, and then carry the same equipment into the next room, who may or may not be another person in contact isolation.
That's the nightmare scenario, and you were a nursing student. Why weren't you being taught to avoid exactly that, Rebecca?
We were, and our instructors would continuously point it out to us, even as we were making comments. But the nursing staff has their routine. It's an excuse, but a lot of nursing staff is overburdened with the number of patients they're caring for, and the priority to them becomes getting through their day and handling the things that come up as quickly as possible.
And so then you have 3 infections and then 24 infections, and we see that same kind of trail right around the country. Rebecca, thanks for calling in. Betsy, you've written about some Iowa hospitals doing a very good job of cracking down on this. Why don't more?
That's right. Well, unfortunately, most hospitals have not made preventing infection a top priority. But one of the most lasting legacies from the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths will be that we are helping medical students learn how to prevent the bacteria from being spread patient to patient on lab coats, gloves, hands, stethoscopes, blood pressure cuffs, wheelchairs, bed rails. You may be very surprised to learn that in most medical schools, medical students don't learn a lot about hygiene. In fact, although they take a first-year microbiology course, not even one class session is devoted to the practical steps needed to prevent the bacteria from moving from patient to patient, on inanimate objects. So we're providing a curriculum to help medical students understand that, so that when they go out on the floor in the third year to treat their first patients, they actually know how to do no harm.
Dr. Farr, when it's done right, would we recognize it? Does it look like a clean room at a high-tech factory, everybody in spacesuits walking around, breathing through ventilators? I mean, or does it look familiar?
No. Remember that the things that are objectionable that we're discussing are invisible, so you couldn't tell the difference between a dirty room and a clean room. Really.
Well, do the doctors dress with, clean suits like we see in computer chips are made, that kind of thing?
No. I mean, what we need to remember, and I want to make a couple of comments.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
One, I want to say something about mandatory public reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say that there's not been any scientific data showing that that controls superbugs like MRSA.
You mean hospitals don't feel ashamed into fixing a problem once it's public?
There are no data. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to, that's hypothesis-based rather than evidence-based.
Okay.
The places that have controlled MRSA have done it by doing what we talked about, which is looking for it and caring for them in isolation. They didn't do it with mandatory public reporting. And if you do mandatory public reporting, it's very unclear what will happen if it's, you know, riddling the entire healthcare system. All of the places look equally bad. So it's not that you're going to be able to identify the one that's got MRSA from the one that doesn't have MRSA. It's all over the place.
But these seven states that Betsy was talking about, Florida, Illinois, Missouri, New York, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Connecticut, all recently enacted laws for this reporting. So wouldn't that give you a hospital-by-hospital look, Dr. Farr?
It's not going to allow the average consumer to distinguish between the one that's bad and the one that's good, remembering that there are multiple variables that determine who gets infected and who doesn't in a hospital.
So you say test
was independent. Let's disagree and say that the public deserves to have this information. Let's not underestimate how smart people are. If you look at a public reporting system, and when I was Lieutenant Governor of New York State, we pioneered public reporting of hospital quality measures. And we started with coronary bypass surgery and measuring how many deaths from coronary bypass surgery in each of the hospitals. And we saw a substantial drop in mortality from coronary bypass surgery once we began reporting and comparing how hospitals performed.
So Dr. Farr says that the research, I'm sure the public would like it. It may just not be in so far.
Let me give an example of what I'm talking about and the lack of science here.
Mm-hmm.
There was one hospital in Pennsylvania after they began having a requirement for reporting infections. In one intensive care unit, they said during a reporting period they had 60 infections, and the director was horrified, and he ordered that there should be no more infections in his unit, that people should do the right thing, and what they should do is wash their hands, and they were taught how to put in catheters.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the next reporting period, there were zero infections. That is frankly incredible.
And that's the way to go, you're saying?
That's not the way things work in reality.
Oh.
And you worry about biased information.
Mm-hmm.
That's not scientific data.
I see.
This is something
well,
that
in fact,
up
we
in
do
an
have evidence
report.
From several hospitals, including the University of Pittsburgh Presbyterian Hospital and Allegheny Hospital, both in the Pittsburgh area, where they have reduced infections in pilot programs 85% to 90% using the kinds of hygiene measures.
Reporting.
But get the hygiene going. Betsy McCoy.
It is plausible to see a substantial decline in infection when proper hygiene is used.
Hey, as a consumer, I say, let me know where the infections are and do the right thing inside the hospital. I want to bring in another perspective here, if I may, from Nashville. Dr. William Schaffner joins us. He's chairman of the Department of Preventive Medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. He's joined us before. Dr. Schaffner, thanks very much for joining us on Point.
Hi, Tom, and hello, Betsy, and hello, Barry.
Dr. Schaffner, we hear numbers that are pretty eye-popping here. We've got listeners calling in saying, my father, my mother died from this kind of infection. I was tormented by it. We've got Barry Farr saying there are ways that this can be treated, and Betsy McCoy as well. Why aren't hospitals doing more? If other countries are getting a lid on this, why isn't the U.S.? Should we be testing the people coming in? Should we be requiring a much higher standard of hygiene within the hospital? Why isn't this happening?
Well, it is, and to some degree, Ms. McCoy is correct, it isn't. There are many institutions, mine among them, Barry's also, that make this an absolute focal point of student, resident, and physician education, nursing education. We pursue it assiduously. Our rates are indeed held within national norms. It's never going to be zero. We take care of such sick patients. It's biologically implausible for it to be zero. Can we do more? Yes. I'd like to say that I'm the one who actually gives the first hand-washing lecture to our students. I wash my hands in front of them. It's a memorable event. our alumni come back and they say, when you washed your hands in front of the students, it's the most memorable lecture in 4 years of medical school. Just a little bit of stage business can make a big impression.
But the national norms you're talking about look pretty bad, as we're hearing them described today. So if they're that bad, how do we clean this up, you know, right across the board? And can we afford to? Can we afford to do what's required to have hospitals that are free of these bugs and not
well,
have
Tom,
them moving
out? Well, Tom, let me weigh in on that issue of can we afford to, because, in fact, that's where my research is.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that hospitals can't afford not to take these precautions, because hospitals are actually losing their financial viability based on hospital infections.
Why? Are they
most
being sued
assume,
or what's happening?
Well, most people assume incorrectly that when a patient stays in a hospital longer because they develop an infection, that the hospital gets paid more. But that's not actually true. Hospitals are paid based on a diagnosis now. So when a patient comes in, say, for a knee repair or coronary bypass surgery and is expected to stay 2 or 3 days and then ends up in the hospital 2 or 3 months with a serious drug-resistant infection, the hospital does not get reimbursed fully for that care. It's a big money loser for them.
Do they
so
also
in fact,
get sued,
hospitals
Betsy?
Can become more profitable. Pardon me?
Do they also get sued for this, or are they vulnerable to lawsuits,
well,
malpractice?
They will be in the future. The fact is that hospitals are entering a new legal environment. In the past, they were shielded from liability because the assumption was that infection is the inevitable risk you face when you go into the hospital. But now there is copious evidence that most of these infections are preventable through good hygiene. And the result is that in the future, hospitals will be sued successfully. In fact, hospital infection could be the next asbestos, the next big basis for class action lawsuits.
William Schaffner, Barry Farr says Northern Europe, Western Australia have knocked this way, way, way down through assiduously confronting it. It's been done in some American hospitals. Should it be done in all? Do we have the right to expect whatever it takes to keep people from fearing that they're going to go into the hospital for knee surgery and come out with a severe infection or dead?
Oh, of course. All hospitals should make this a priority, and there are hospitals who should do more. This is a complex problem. It has everything to do with using antibiotics appropriately, stopping them when they're no longer needed, choosing the antibiotic wisely, doing appropriate hygiene, keeping the length of stay as short as possible, having appropriate staffing ratios on every unit. So
what about testing incoming patients? Dr. Barry Farr says test them when they come if they look like they might have an MRSA problem, an infection problem.
And there are a variety of approaches to that that different hospitals use. We use a culturing approach that is not as far as Barry, but it's nonetheless on consistent, I would say, with what the CDC recommends, and our infection rates are comfortably low. So you have to respond to your local circumstances. I think that all hospitals dealing with very, very complex, highly sick patients, older patients increasingly, patients on chemotherapy with HIV infection, getting transplants of all kinds, have a population of infection-prone individuals within them. And so, obviously, we all have to work on that. Every hospital has an infection control committee. The question is whether every hospital is doing quite enough.
And clearly, it's not with the national numbers we're seeing, and Dr. Farr calls it egregiously out of control. Maureen's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Maureen. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I just have to comment on, you asked before, would your doctor be insulted if you asked him to clean his hands,
yeah,
or she? I have to tell you, my mom entered a major New York City hospital for repair of a broken shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
That is all that was wrong with her.
Mm-hmm.
I, unfortunately, am haunted by this. I witnessed two doctors change her dressing without either washing their hands or putting on gloves. We later found that dirty dressing in her bed. Days later, my mother was running 106.7 fever. She was put on a ventilator. She eventually became immobilized, was unable to move anything but her head.
What was the problem?
She contracted infections. Among them were MRSA, VRE. her body had multi-organism sepsis. It was her diagnosis.
Did she survive?
She did not survive. She suffered unbelievably for 4 months on a ventilator, a feeding tube, unable to move anything but her head, no communication with us. We sat by her bedside for 4 months.
For a broken shoulder? What did the hospital say, Maureen?
The hospital, I went to administration, and I was frankly shocked. I had heard of infections. I thought you took antibiotics and you got better. I said to them, how could this have happened? What happened? I was actually told that these infections were the cost of doing the business of medicine, that every day in every hospital in America, people contract these infections and die of these infections.
Well, that may be true, but that's not what anybody wants to hear.
No, it is not. I was told by the administrator, you have to accept this.
Wow.
And I frankly refuse to. And I cannot stress strongly enough, I am haunted by that image. Speak up. Don't be afraid of insulting the doctor. You are the best advocate for yourself and your loved ones.
Maureen,
you care to the
we've got it loud and clear.
It shouldn't depend upon the individual patient, because sometimes the patient is comatose and can't speak up for him or herself.
And the family's not always there.
This is a system error, and it needs to be addressed system-wide if we're going to control it, just like they do in Northern Europe.
How do you suggest the system be brought to controlling this, Dr. Farr? If public reporting of infection rates is not enough, if the CDC hasn't been tough enough or on top of it, how's it going to happen?
We just have to deal responsibly with the problem. We have to control it.
What's the leverage to make that happen if 90,000 deaths?
It should not be allowed to be out of control. It should be controlled.
If 90,000 deaths isn't enough so far every year to make it get under control, what's the leverage that's going to bring that about, Dr. Farr?
Well, that's exactly, Tom, that is the important question, and that's why public reporting is essential. That's why it's important to know that hospitals will be liable if patients continue to become infected, because now we have very, very compelling evidence that most of these infections are preventable.
I understand that perspective, but very far you're saying that this public reporting is not enough. So how do you make it happen?
I don't believe public reporting is going to be the answer, because that's never been shown to control the superbugs. That's not what was used. I think what should be done is, I mean, in Northern Europe, they require hospitals to follow, for example, the Dutch guideline in Holland. They have to do it. In the United States, it's optional. In the CDC doesn't say you should screen, you should find who has it, and care for them in isolation.
So do you want federal law describing how doctors and nurses have to wash up and keep the stethoscope clean?
Well, the washing up and the cleaning their own hands and things isn't probably as important as knowing who has it and then using proper precautions when they know who has it.
Dr. Schaffner, would you like to see legislation or regulation requiring hospitals to test on the way in? I mean, we need this changed, and it's not changing. It's going the wrong way now.
Tom, H.L. Mencken said, for every complex problem, there's a simple solution. That's wrong. This is a very complex problem that requires a multifactorial solution. I am not convinced that culturing on admission is important. For example, recently in Nashville, we did a study of healthy children. 9% of them had MRSA in the nose.
So what would you say to Maureen, who lost her mother and the hospital says this
yes.
is just the cost of doing medicine, doing business?
No. Oh, that's a terrible thought. And as I listened to her story, and we'll accept it as told, I was chagrined, embarrassed, and actually enraged that doctors would be so cavalier in changing addressing. And perhaps that was indeed part of what caused that infection. But it was certainly indicative that those physicians did not adhere to elementary infection control precautions. I think part of what Barry is saying, and actually Betsy is saying too, is that we have to enhance the professional consciousness about doing infection control each and every time we contact a patient. That's what we try to teach at Vanderbilt.
Dr. William Schaffner at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Indeed. Good to be with you, Tom.
And Dr. Barry Farr at the University of Virginia, epidemiologist in Charlottesville, Virginia, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Betsy McCoy, founder and chairman of the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths. Betsy, make it happen. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.